Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I'm delighted to welcome to the show Drs. Alex Lickerman and Ash Delfrawi. Did I say that right, Ash? Ash Delfrawi.
Perfect.
And I asked earlier, and I am so sorry. Okay, so these are the authors of a new book called The 10 Worlds, The New Psychology of Happiness. The book is on its way to me, and I have not had a chance to read it, but after speaking with them in a pre-interview call, I cannot wait to get it on my desk. So in this episode, they're going to talk about ways we are mistaken about our beliefs about happiness, what core delusions are, the 10 worlds, which is fascinating, by the way, and how to determine which one we are currently living in, and then finally, how to challenge our own beliefs. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm excited to have you here. And before we get started, tell people a bit about yourselves, because you two have fascinating stories.
Sure. So I guess I'll go first. This is Alex Lickerman. I am a physician, a primary care physician, and my background is I trained at the University of Chicago and actually spent 20 years there running primary care for 7 of those years, and then student health, and then eventually left in 2016 to found my own concierge primary care medical practice called Imagine MD.
And this is Ash. Good morning. I also studied at the University of Chicago. I got my undergraduate and master's degree in biology and then in social psychology, and then went on to get my doctorate in clinical psychology and was a practicing clinical psychologist. Focused a lot on marriage and family counseling, but more broadly as well. I later actually in my life transitioned into a career in marketing and have been an executive in companies such as Google, Wrigley, Gogo, and currently actually the chief marketing officer at Redbox.
And I found that fascinating. When I did a little background research on both of you, I went, okay, how did he get to Redbox? How did he get to all these different places when he's a doctor? I still am not sure I know the answer. That may be another conversation. But that leads me into my big question, because from the conversation that we had a week or so ago about the book, which, seriously, when I tell you I can't wait to read it, but how in the world did two gentlemen with, you know, such scientific backgrounds come to believe in something, you know, that some people may consider mystical, and it's absolutely philosophical from what I've read. So how did you get down that path?
Right. Well, so lots to unpack there. So the thing I didn't tell you in my background was that I've also been a practicing Buddhist since 1989, but really from a scientific perspective. And so you're absolutely right that a lot of the stuff, especially in the last chapter of the book, which is titled Enlightenment, people might take to mean we're talking about sort of a mystical phenomenon, a faraway thing that only Buddhists meditating in caves in Tibet might achieve. But one of the things we wanted to achieve with the book was to actually show there's a lot of science behind this idea of enlightenment, and we can talk about that later as we get into it. But the whole book really is science-based, but also it is philosophical because there's an intersection between some philosophy and science, as well as psychological. But in terms of how Ash and I got interested in this, I can tell from my perspective that, you know, when we met, we actually met about 30 years ago when we were both in college and at the beginning of our careers, even before we actually had embarked on our careers. And we're very interested in happiness then, just from a perspective of, you know, wanting to be happy ourselves. And as we began our journey down our respective paths, we got interested in the science of it. And Ash, I think, can talk about how his interest as a psychologist. My interest really was a personal interest in that in high school, I had always wondered about this notion of enlightenment and wondered if it could really be a real thing or if it was just, as you say, this mystical imaginary thing. And I had gotten into Zen Buddhism a little bit in high school, but found it quite inaccessible. And then my first year of medical school, I met a woman who was practicing a different form of Buddhism that I decided to try. And that took me on this journey, this idea that enlightenment was a possible thing, and I sought after it for a very long time in my practice of Buddhism. And ultimately, through the research Ash and I did for this book and writing the book, came to conclude there was a strong scientific basis behind this notion that anyone can attain a life condition of enlightenment, and that's sort of what we wrote about.
Yeah, and from my perspective, I came at it quite differently, obviously driven by my own desires to figure out why happiness was such a difficult thing to maintain and seemed that not at the mercy of kind of all the things that happened to you. But then as I embarked on my professional career, you know, then I was really just struck by candidly how bad people are being happy. Now, clearly people came to me when they were, you know, at the lowest points or they're running out of ways to do it. So, you know, it's a little bit biased, but the reality is everybody struggle with it. And in practicing, I just realized that, you know, people just really, really struggle with having tools or a way of thinking about the world that allow them to have happiness to sort of last or endures as bad things happen to them. And it was interesting to watch how, you know, people do the same things over and over again, despite all the different things that happen to demonstrate to them that that does not work or that path does not work. Why do you keep trying to repeat it? And so in trying to come to answers to that, Alex and I sort of came together. We jokingly talk about it's like, you know, peanut butter and chocolate sort of came together to create this nice perspective of science, philosophy, empirical cases, clinical research. And so the book brings all that together, which what I would argue is not at all about kind of how you achieve this in a spiritual, mystical way, but in a very real, practical way in your life.
And I should also point out that the genesis of the book really was Ash. You know, when I was beginning to practice Buddhism and I was telling him about this philosophical system that Buddhist philosophers from 2,500 years ago had literally spent centuries in observation putting together this 10 worlds paradigm, he was really struck by that and thought that that might have a psychological backing and construct and got very interested in that. And so that's really what we've been spending the last 23 years exploring, as there's been an explosion of research in helping people how to become happy. What has become apparent to us is while these studies are very valuable and really are useful, they really don't get at the core of what it is that makes people happy and unhappy. And we thought that there was something in this 2,500-year-old construct of the 10 worlds that really has something to teach us in the modern world that got at the core of what happiness is all about, and that's what we tried to explore in the book.
Okay, and that leads me to my next question, because my observation of my own life is that happiness is really kind, in my life anyway, is made up of little moments, little pockets of just absolute joy. And it can be anything. It can be this morning I was sitting on my back porch in the rain. I mean, if it's a covered porch, but quite chilly. It was raining. It was cold. I was so darn happy. I love this kind of weather. But then, I know, it's crazy. But then, you know, I come in, go to my email, and instantly my happiness is like, well, God darn it, here we go. So I have to kind of pull back and remember just, you know, how delightful it was to be out there in that kind of cold, dreary weather that other people may not like. So my observation is that happiness is kind of a fleeting thing. It pops up in pockets during the day, but you have to really pay attention, enjoy it, and kind of hang on to it. Because from moment to moment, minute to minute, hour to hour, there's so many outside influences that are going to impact how you feel at that moment. Or am I just way off base?
No, actually, what you're describing is exactly what I think happens, and our book is an attempt to explain why that happens. And so we argue
case study, because, once in a while I'll look at myself and go, well, really, that sucks. Last night, just as a for instance, I fell asleep on the couch, which I almost never do. I just don't nap. I'm not a big sleeper. I fell asleep, and I slept so hard that when I woke up and looked at the clock and saw that it was 6 o'clock, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what in the heck is going on? I closed off the lights. I turned on the alarm. I'd only been asleep for an hour. It was not Friday. I thought it was Friday. So, I mean, and that took me back quite a bit. I have no idea how that happened. And I'm telling you, it took me a couple of hours to get over it. So what was that all about?
Ash, why don't you take that one?
I knew it was going to get kicked out. It's like, okay, we're talking to a crazy lady here. Sorry.
Well, I mean,
it was just one of those times where I landed in this weird pocket of time that didn't make sense to me. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Well, at some point, you know, we... I think in the book, we start getting into, I think this actually moves into the last chapter, Alex, a little bit in terms of what she was describing earlier on around when you're out enjoying, you know, you're having this moments out where in the weather that you enjoy, and then when you came back and life sort of hit you, and then your happiness seemed to be fleeting. And like Alex said, we do, you know, we actually talk about that in a lot of the book, and then part of it we talk about, you know, that paying attention or actually the things, you know, you have to kind of know when things are calling attention in your life and what they're kind of stirring up in you. And that, and in order to maintain kind of a level of happiness that lasts, you have to kind of pay attention to the right things. And then for you, it seems like there was something about that weather, whether it was dreary or rainy or something outside, that actually triggered that for you. Is that something that happens for you pretty often? Every time you, or is that rare for you?
Falling asleep like that, extremely rare. And I have to tell you, I had to fight back to any kind of equilibrium. I mean, I was confused. I was irritated. You know, I live alone, and I caught myself looking over my shoulder to see if anybody noticed how awful it was. It was really challenging. And I think that's why I'm bringing it up, because it was very challenging.
Yeah, so that actually may have a pretty grounded, simple scientific explanation, which is that when people wake up from certain stages of sleep, if you happen to be awakened from the deepest stages of sleep, stage four, because, you know, something happened in your environment, a loud noise or whatever, you can be quite confused, and it can take a while to orient yourself. And if your expectation was it was going to be, I guess, Thursday or Friday, and it wasn't, that can be very disconcerting. But, you know, to get back to what you were just describing about how your happiness sort of literally changes from moment to moment to moment, the question that we try to answer in the book is, why does that happen, right? So if you think about this, it's been a very long time. Certainly philosophers have acknowledged this, but now even psychologists have acknowledged that how happy we are moment is much more determined by what's inside of us than what's going on around us, right? Sort of our inner life state. The term we use is life condition or world. What world are we in? And what we're arguing in the book is that the reason our level of happiness, our mood, all those things flip from moment to moment is because we are literally flipping from inner life state to inner life state, from, say, the state of hell where we're in terrible suffering to the state of rapture where we're joyous. Because as different things in our environment happen to us, as the rain falls, as we look at email, as thoughts enter our minds from who knows where, all of those things are triggers of beliefs that we have. And those beliefs are what create the inner life state or the life conditions that we have. So I'll give you an example. So let's say, you know, you were in this state of rapture enjoying the rain, and then you opened your email and read an email from someone telling you about something that, you know, you owe the IRS money, for example, right? Well, that's another environmental stimulus that triggers a belief in you, and that belief could be anything from, oh no, I don't have enough money to give the IRS, I don't know how to solve that problem, I'm powerless to fix that, and then you are plunged into the life state of hell, based not just on the environmental trigger, that email, but on your belief about what it means. And so what's happening is we are constantly having beliefs stirred up in us about the meaning of the things that happen to us, and it is those beliefs that push us from life state to life state and determine how happy we can be. And so what we do in the book is, if you think about all the beliefs that all people on the planet have about what they need to be happy, and you distill them all the way down to their basic essence, we are arguing that there are 10 basic beliefs about what people need to be happy that are constantly being stirred up by our environment. And it is the stirring up of these beliefs that actually determine how happy we are. And we also argue that 9 of those beliefs are wrong. We think that in pursuing these certain things, we will achieve lasting happiness, but in fact, we won't. And that's why we call those, as you mentioned earlier, the core delusions.
Now, you're talking about the Ten Worlds, which is the title of the book. Can you give us a quick description or a quick rundown what those Ten Worlds are? And then we'll talk about why most of them are... Now, let me make sure I'm understanding this correctly. There's the Ten Worlds, but then there's those ten core beliefs that you said that nine are wrong.
Yes. So
let's talk about that
world,
because now I'm a little bit... I'm very curious.
Yeah, about the worlds. So like Alex said, the worlds are sort of created by these core the beliefs that you have that are stirred up that create they're very powerful and they're very foundational, and to the point where they kind of create these 10 life states, life states of 10 worlds. I can quickly kind of run through them, and then we can get into the core delusion piece of this. So the lowest, as not surprising, is the world of hell, which is really what we call the world of suffering. Whereas you can imagine, it's actually fairly self-descriptive. It's really you have this sense of everything doom and gloom and hopelessness and all the things that kind of go along with feeling like your suffering just won't stop. Then we have the world of hunger, which is this world where there's a belief that to be happy, it's about getting what you want. It's about that next thing. It's about always wanting that next thing that's just that you believe if you get it, it will make you happy. So it's this world of desire, of like, just desiring to achieve the very next thing that you believe your happiness is contained in. Then the world of animality, which is really the world of what we call the world of instinct, which is about physical pleasure. So that's the world about pleasure seeking, usually physical. So whether that's through eating or drugs or alcohol or sex or what have you, it's about, fulfilling physical desires. Then it's the world of anger, which is really about the world of ego. It's about the world of feeling like you have to be better than others. Often it's a world that's fueled by insecurities that you're constantly trying to conquer and battle. Then the world, my world, which is the world of tranquility, which can be anything but tranquil. It's the world of trying to find serenity in your life, and it's usually through trying to avoid pain and negative outcomes and trying to kind of pursue this peace of mind that's so elusive and can be riddled with anxiety as you constantly try to figure out ways to avoid bad things happening to you, believing that will make you happy. Then the world of rapture, which is the world of joy, and this is a world where lots of energy, lots of positivity. It's a world where people really find joy through in the things that they have and the attachments in their lives, and they whether that's everything from something physical like their car or their spouse or their job, but it's the world of really approaching the world in a fairly positive way and enjoying the things you have. Of course, there's a large flip side to that, which is in that world, people tend to place a lot of their joy and happiness in the attachment. So when they lose them, they can plunge. They can be the source of their biggest misery as well. Those are what we call the lower worlds, and the higher worlds. We can get into later into why they're lower and higher worlds. But then the higher worlds, just the types of happiness tends to be a little bit more desirable, durable, enduring. The first of the higher worlds is learning. Which is the world of mastery. It's the world of that is about creating meaning and value, and finding a lot of happiness and creating meaningful things. Then the world of realization, which is really about personal growth and self-improvement, and people who really strive to focus on becoming better and growing and finding a lot of joy from the ability to become a better person. Then the world of compassion, which is really about, as you imagine, it's about gaining a lot of enjoyment and happiness from your life, from helping other people become happier or easing their suffering or making people, helping people through pain. And that is very highly motivating, satisfying, and gives people a great sense of happiness. And then enlightenment, which I'm sure we'll talk about, which is, we'll get into that. It's really about seeing the world in a way that creates a type of happiness that can't be destroyed no matter what happens to you. Those are the 10.
Excellent. And I know people are going to ask, well, how do you sustain constant happiness? And is that even possible? Or are you working towards it and recognizing where you are on, I'm going to call it a scale. I know you're calling it the worlds, but you know, is it a matter of just recognizing where you are in the moment and saying, maybe this isn't where I want to be. Let me step over here instead.
It's, I think what we're saying in the book is that there are literally different types of happiness. And, you know, we all want happiness that lasts. And we're chasing after that happiness in the way we think we're most likely to get it. And that's based on these beliefs. So, for example, Ash talked about the world of animality, where the core delusion about what happiness is that happiness is the same thing as pleasure. And if you think about that for a minute, if you are someone who at your core really believes that the way to become happy is to experience as much basic physical pleasure as possible, that will determine everything you do. It'll determine what you value, and it'll determine how often you are happy. Because in fact, sadly, as we know, people who devote their lives to purely physical pleasure often are among the most miserable people that you meet, people who are addicted to drugs or food or sex or any of those things. But, you know, in general, though, if you think about what most people think of happiness is what we talk about in rapture. That is joy that comes to you from contemplating attachment. So that may be your spouse. It may be your dog. It may be your job. It may be a beautiful day that you know, a rainy day that for whatever reason you find pleasurable and enjoyable. The problem with seeking that type of happiness, what we call relative happiness in the world of rapture, is that it is always temporary. It's like chewing a stick of gum. It tastes really sweet at first, but the flavor always fades. And fades for a number of reasons. One is because it's just the way our brains are built, that we get used to all the good things that we have, and they stop triggering that joy in us the longer we have them. We just sort of get used to them. And so what many people do as a strategy is they will try to find new attachments, things that are fresh and new to give them that burst of flavor again and that joy. But even then, it continues to be temporary. So to answer your question, we do believe and argue in the book that there is an entirely different type of happiness that's possible, a happiness that is not determined or based on attachment, on having anything, but a happiness that is determined by a way of perceiving the world around us. And this is the world of enlightenment. So part of the reason we wrote this book wasn't just to sort of describe what we think is going on and explain why people shift their levels of happiness from moment to moment to moment, but to inspire people to actually seek after enlightenment, just to try to convince them that it's not just this mystical, far-off fairy tale state, but something everyone can enjoy if they work at it. And it comes down to seeing the world in a way that produces the emotion of awe. That we are arguing is the indestructible, fundamental emotion and life state that can bring a happiness that cannot be, that can resist being pulled down by any loss or any tragedy.
And that actually makes perfect sense to me. I mean, if you look at things and you're a little bit awestruck, I mean, how can you be unhappy in that moment? And it doesn't matter to me if you've seen it a half a dozen times or thousands of times. If it's, you know, we can go through our house and go, has that always been there? I'm guilty of that. It's like, where did that come from? Yeah, we don't see the things that are surrounding us. Now all of a sudden you've got something new to look at and go, let me dig into those memories and see what was going on there. But I think you're right. I think we get so surrounded by things and people and experiences that we lose that simple, I would think it would be a simple ability to just be awestruck.
Well, it's like children are really good at this, right? Everything is new to them. They walk around in a state of continual awe, and children typically are among the happiest creatures we see on the planet. And what ends up happening is we grow up and we get used to the world, and it becomes every day to us, and we lose the ability to be awestruck by the world. But if you really thought about it, if you could recapture that ability, I mean, awe is this really interesting emotion that has not been very well studied, has not been very well understood, or even often experienced by people. They typically associate with religious experiences, but in fact, it can be quite divorced from any religious experience whatsoever. And as we're learning about what triggers awe and what the experience of awe is like, It really is an emotion that has the ability to sustain us and enable us to transcend whatever earthly pain or suffering we may be experiencing. And Ash and I will contend that there are methods and ways that you can develop your ability to be awestruck by the world more than you are now, and in doing so, establish a state of happiness and joy that cannot be rocked by anything.
So let me ask you this, because you both of you have mentioned core delusions a couple of times. So I'm guessing that in order to get to that stage where you deliberately and then unconsciously practice awe, do you have to really overcome those core delusions? And if so, what are those core delusions?
I can start that, and Alex can build on that a little bit. So let me just start by saying, just clearly defining what they are. So I think Alex mentioned up front that everybody has these beliefs about what happiness is for them, and we argue, in the book, we say that if we took all these beliefs about what happiness is, you can slot them into 10 fundamental, basic beliefs of what happiness is. And then we argue that 9 of those are wrong. And so that's what the core delusion is. There's those fixed basic beliefs about what you think happiness is, that while they will give you a temporary hit of happiness, in some cases more than others, ultimately it's a type of happiness that will not endure or last, and you'll find it sort of fleeting and hard to hold on to. So those are the 9 core delusions. And I think that in order to achieve, the state Alex talked about, clearly you have to become better and better at not letting those delusions have you in their grip and completely being kind of the subconscious or unconscious driver of your happiness that's going to then fling you left and right or up and down all the time. And you have to kind of release yourself from the grip of that. My belief is, and I'll talk about that, is that the more you can get better or train yourself to have these experiences or experience awe and allow yourself to have to be in that state, the less those beliefs will get you in their grip, and because you'll understand or gain the wisdom in your life that there is a type of happiness that's very different, that's not at the mercy of the things that happen to me in my environment or to the attachments I form in my life. So I don't know if we directly correlated something that you have to, I don't think we've directly said you have to eliminate these things systematically, but I do think it's about getting more control and understanding that those are delusions and they will not lead to that. They will then fuel your ability to kind of enter this other world and spend more time there.
So I'd answer that question by saying there's 2 ways in which we can deal with these core delusions. The first is, as Ash said, most of these operate in our lives unconsciously. We don't realize that, for example, the belief that pleasure and happiness are one and the same might be a belief that's driving our behavior. We're unconscious of it. And any time you are unconscious or unaware of a belief that's driving you, it governs you completely. You know, the first step to be able to free yourself from believing it or even just from behaving in the way a belief drives you to behave is to become aware of it. And so our first goal in writing the book was to help people become aware of these beliefs that may be operating in their own lives. But to Ash's point as well, we're not arguing that you can necessarily free yourself from these beliefs. They're incredibly fundamental. They're built based on early childhood experiences that people all over the world and every culture will experience, as well as just the way our brains are constructed, right? I mean, pleasure is hard, by definition, is built in our brains to draw us toward pleasure. That's how we function. So to form a belief that pleasure and happiness are the same is almost unavoidable. However, we don't have to behave according to that belief. We can recognize when that belief is stirred up in us and say, I at this moment where I'm tempted to eat all this garbage food, what's really driving this is I'm in the grip of this belief that pleasure and happiness are the same thing, and I can forgo this pleasure and still be happy, and so I can resist eating this food when I understand what's driving me toward it is a deep belief that I'm going to be happy if I eat this food. But then the flip side of this is to enter into the life condition of enlightenment, to actually experience awe every moment or even at a moment, and to feel the transcendent joy that state brings, in a sense, frees you from those delusions. It's not that you necessarily don't believe them, but their influence on you dramatically diminishes. And so I think the real answer here is not necessarily to try to disbelieve these things. They're very hard to disbelieve. But to become mindful of them, 1, and 2, to try to enter in a state where they just don't have you in their grip, that you can easily turn away from them so that your behavior is not controlled by them in a way that actually makes you more unhappy than happy.
Okay, so if you're, let's use your food analogy here. Let's say you've ripped open a bag of chips and you're just kind of mindlessly eating them. Do you catch yourself going, did I really want this? Is this good for me? Do you have a little mini conversation with you? How do you get out of that kind of moment, I guess is my question, because we're all guilty of mindless eating. I catch myself doing it every now and then, and I'll stop and say, what the heck are you doing? Why?
Right.
Where does this even come from?
Well, I think that's exactly it. I think that when we do most of the things we do mindlessly, meaning out of habit, and if we, the first step towards changing a behavior that you don't like is to make it transition from being mindless to mindful. And yet that's not enough, right? Because you may notice and say, hey, wait, why am I eating this food? I didn't even really notice I was doing it. Do I really want to do this? And you may still feel
right,
a great desire
to do it. Right,
but I'm
already committed. The bag is open.
Right,
now what?
Exactly, right.
Jeez.
Well, then I think, you know, our answer would be really excavate down to understand what belief is motivating you to eat them. Now, it may not just be a belief, right? You may actually be hungry. It may be a basic drive that is part of our animalistic, you know, drive to survive, that when we're hungry, we eat. You don't have to believe anything to you know, behave that way, to eat things. But if you're eating mindlessly, like overeating, like you're not actually hungry, and you ask yourself, why am I doing this? I think that kind of mindful self-examination is crucial to it. But if your goal should be, what is it I believe that it's about eating this food that's going to make me happy? If you pose the question that way, you will much more quickly get down to the basic motivational belief that's got you in its grip. And if you're honest with yourself and you're able to, you know, have any degree of ability to self-reflect and ask yourself, well, yeah, I guess I believe, we'll contend in most cases, that will be, I'm doing this because I think the pleasure of eating is going to make me happy. And here's the funny thing. It does. You're not wrong. It does make you happy temporarily. But it can also, in the long run, make you more unhappy, because what if you're actually trying to lose weight and you're at cross purposes with yourself? And then what ends up happening is you're doing this very rapid mental calculus. You know, when you're approaching a dessert or a bag of chips, you're saying, well, okay, I can get a temporary hit of happiness now, but I'll pay for that later by more unhappiness later. And which belief is being stirred up to a greater extent, that to be happy, you need to be thin, or to be happy, you have to enjoy the pleasure of eating these chips? We'll argue that it's whichever belief is stirred up more intensely, that's what determines your behavior. And so becoming aware of this mental struggle that you're having in those terms, we think is empowering to people, and it will help them to behave in a way that is more likely to enable them to become happy long-term and more enduringly.
And that makes perfect sense. So basically stop, reflect, and then make a new decision.
And in there, ask yourself, what is the belief about what you need to be happy at that moment that has you in its grip? Because that really, we're arguing, is the true motivator of your behavior. And when you shine a light on that belief, we think that gives you the power to resist it, to actually make a determination that is not mindless, but mindful.
Okay, so you're not actually just bossing yourself around. You're saying, you know, I mean, it's easy to say, you know, Denise, these chips are not good. They're too salty. You're going to be thirsty. You can have a whole little mini argument. I really don't like chips, so I'm just kind of making this up as I go. But I'm guessing that would be the argument. But instead of having a little series of mini arguments with yourself, you would actually drill down and say, is this making me happy now? Is this going to make me happy later? And then explore those two avenues instead of having, you know, the arguments, well, you're not the boss of me. We all do that. You're not. I argue with my nerve system. You're not the boss of me. And then I go get lost.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, this is the people, when they're trying to change their behaviors, have that mental jujitsu, whatever you described, happening all the time. And in fact, you know, as a core part of therapy, actually is to sometimes actually help people articulate these debates that they're having in this grapple, because it causes them a lot of anxiety and conflict, and they try to resolve it because, you know, they're feeling guilt. And they talk about it in different terms. They feel guilt versus the pleasure and all this kind of, I think that's still healthy. We can do that. But what we're arguing is if you want to fundamentally try to get at your kind of what's truly motivating you, and maybe why you're really grappling with changing certain behaviors that you just know ultimately at the end of the day don't make you happy, then doing the work to try to understand or dig down deeper to try to figure out exactly what your beliefs are about truly true happiness are going to ultimately yield, I think, more, you know, your ability to kind of gain control over more. So, you know, but, you know, arguing with you, the dialogue you have, people have all the time, is not just around food, right? It's around exercise. It's around money. It's around all these different things and that people grapple with. And for each of those cases, we believe there's something happening at a much more foundational level about what they believe about being happy that's really the driver. And until you find, until you sort of awaken to that and confront that, then you're going to get stuck in these kind of, in these debates in your head over and over and over again. So I mentioned earlier on that my frustration in therapy was that exactly this, why people recognize this self-destructive but come back to it again and again and again, it's because they're having the same dialogue and they're not asking the right question and they're not really digging the level to the level of understanding they need to try to drive real change and wisdom in their lives.
Can you guys offer some steps where people can stop in the moment and start to drill down, you know, deeper than just a little mini argument that you're having with yourself, which, frankly, I tend to lose those arguments. I'm a great debater. So, you know, I lose half the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's nothing to be proud of, by the way. So,
yeah.
So can you assist our audience in saying, okay, try this instead?
Yeah, so there's a fascinating – you actually want to take that and I'll
– No, go ahead. I mean, I'll add – why don't you start and then I'll add on.
Okay. There's a fascinating body of literature about how people stop bad habits. You know, bad habits, simple stuff like chewing your nails, you know, when you're nervous versus, you know, continually not exercising when you want to, giving yourself excuses. And what's interesting is that the problem that we have is that, as we said earlier, most of our behavior is mindless. It's habitual. It's actually controlled at a part of the brain where we're not actually consciously paying attention to it. It's sort of like, you know, why when you get into a car do most people automatically put on their seatbelt without thinking? It's because getting in the car triggers that behavior, right? So if you are, you know, confronted with, say, a delicious plate of chocolate cookies and you're on a diet and don't want to eat those cookies, and you're driven to sort of, you know, want to eat those and maybe just, you know, find your hand reaching towards a cookie and your mouth eating it before you even realize what you're doing, the first step has to be to draw your conscious attention to what you're doing. And this is challenging because, of course, our brains are built to do stuff habitually because it's efficient. And when you're not paying attention to what you're doing, you're literally not paying attention. So what triggers you to become mindful? And you have to just train yourself. You have to program yourself. So if it's a recurrent problem, like indulging in eating when you feel you shouldn't, you have to sort of program yourself that every time you actually begin to notice, oh, look what I've done. I have a cookie in my hand. And in fact, what studies show when you're trying to stop an unconscious habit is the best way to actually make yourself mindful of it is to speak aloud the word stop. So this is how, for example, I've trained patients of mine who are mangling their nails with anxiety to stop mangling their nails by when they notice that their fingers are in their mouth, to literally say the word aloud, stop. This is also, by the way, how I trained my son to stop sucking his thumb. It was amazing to me. It actually only took him a week. He was 4, I think, and I sat down and I said, so here's the reason why you need to stop sucking your thumb. The dentist has said if you continue doing this, you're going to have problems with your teeth. So what I want you to do, every time you notice that your thumb is in your mouth, say the word stop and pull it out of your mouth. And in doing that, he became mindful of and actually stopped the habit in 1 week. So, you know, you have to apply your own creativity to whatever situation you may be struggling with to apply that solution. But it's basically just a trick to get yourself to take a mindless process and make it mindful. That's the first step. Sash, maybe you want to pick up.
Kind of like the rubber band trick.
Yeah.
You put a rubber band on your wrist, and when you're having
stinking
thinking, you just snap that rubber band, which hurts. So, yeah, I see where you're going with that.
Yeah. And the other part, so I would say that, you know, look, the reality is this takes a little bit of work and on yourself to understand this. And so one of the – we believe that – first, it starts with kind of understanding or that there is and buying into the fact that there are certain beliefs about what you happiness are that are potentially driving some of this behaviors that you're or the issues that you're running into your life. And we believe there's actually power that comes from that. So, for example, when we started this journey, I did not think I came from the world of tranquility. That was slightly a surprise to me. But the more and more we understood it, the more and more we did our research, the more and more I then took that research and tried to apply it in my own life, the more it became very obvious to me that while I spent lots of time in different worlds, that where my core belief, or where my base, what we call in the book, your basic life tendency, which is where you spend most of your time, or the belief you hold the strongest, was clearly the will of tranquility, because I was governed by this belief that I could be happy if I could avoid, you know, pain, emotional pain or bad outcomes. And if I could just make the decisions or avoid the decisions that would potentially lead to bad outcomes, I could chase this peace of mind, which is very important to me. And my life was very insidiously being sort of constructed that way. But literally when I came to understand this, that this is a delusion, and in fact, even seeing research in my own life, realizing that we are really bad at actually predicting what outcomes or how, you know, we actually want from our decisions that make us happy. We're usually wrong most of the time. It was really a freeing experience. I started realizing when I faced big decisions about, you know, my jobs or moving or even kids, putting the kids in the right school, or, you know, all these things you face that you feel if you get it wrong, you are, you know, you doom yourself or your family, your kids, or somebody to not being happy. That's paralyzing. And when I realized that, I started like letting go of that, realizing that my happiness is not somehow, you know, sitting in this, the right decision or not. And in doing that, it's been incredibly freeing, and allowed me to be much more willing to, you know, trust my instincts around different things, or be okay with the fact that a decision might not be perfect or the right one, that I can be happy no matter what, my family will be happy no matter what. So it released a sense of anxiety that I carried around in me because of that belief. And that's just one example. And I think that if it's something that I think can be replicated for everybody. And so, you know, understanding what those beliefs are, bringing it into your awareness when you're faced with these things, and that is a freeing experience. And so we hope that by people reading the book, and that we wrote the book in a manner, I don't know if we talked about that, each chapter is really a case with a real story, with real people, and we hope that people can see parts of themselves in that, and makes it much more accessible for people, and relate to it in some way, figure out for them which world or belief they're really holding on to. And then I think by understanding that, it will allow them to get a little more control of their lives and release some of the grip this delusion might have on them, and hopefully can really change their way they think about achieving happiness can be much more than just kind of this temporary thing.
When you're talking about the 10 worlds, how did you discover these? Because that's a pretty specific number.
Right. It actually comes from Buddhist philosophy. There were Buddhist philosophers going back as far as 2,500 years who literally spent century after century kind of observing all the states in which human beings exist, and they're the ones who sort of developed the model. And the idea being that, you know, to have more than 10 would have been to create two states that were essentially identical, and to have fewer than 10, they argued, would have been to combine two separate states into one in a way that didn't make sense. And so it really comes from, frankly, millennia of empirical observation of human beings. And it's only recently that what we did is look at recent psychological research that sort of supports the model and argues that it's a pretty functional and useful way of thinking about the inner life states that people go through. And when people read the book, I think they'll find they recognize not just themselves in some of these stories, but all the people they know, that they really do categorize this way.
So Denise, one thing.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just going to say that we have a website that you can go in and literally take, you know, before you have to read the whole book, you can take a 3-minute or so assessment that tells you which world we believe might be your basic life tendency or where you come from. And it's really been kind of fun because, like at my work, everybody's done it, and it's really interesting to spring in the interesting debates and realizations and the light bulbs that have come on for people as they start realizing, oh my God, I guess I do believe these things. And it's been really fascinating to watch, you know, just a little simple insight as to maybe what's something that's been sort of that you've been clinging to that's maybe undeniable has completely shift the way you kind of might start thinking about your life. And so it's been, I would encourage people, that's one the first step you can do to learn this could be that and see how it feels.
Ash, I have that in the show notes. Yeah, but I was going to say, give us the URL so people can go there.
Yeah, so it's www.the10worlds.com. And there's just an assessment tab. You go there, it'll start it out for you, and you'll be done in 3 minutes, and it will tell you what world we believe you come from. And then you can go there on the site. There's a very high-level kind of quick blurb on each world. So they give you a sense whether it feels right to you or not. And then, obviously, if you're really interested, the book will really dive into each of them in more detail.
While you're on that top, thank you for that. While you're on that, can you give us just kind of a shortened version of the 10 worlds? I think we've touched on it briefly, but if you can just kind of go down the range so people can go, ooh, that's me, or maybe not, but I'll look at that.
Yeah, I can do that. So very quickly, hell is the life condition of suffering. So anytime you begin to suffer, whether in a very small amount or an overwhelming amount, you are in the life condition of hell. And so anybody who typically, no matter what happens to them, is always feeling oppressed and depressed probably comes from that world. The next world is the world of hunger, which is characterized by sort of this insatiable yearning for the next thing, that nothing you get really quite satisfies. And so typically people will continue searching for something they think is going to ultimately fill them up. And people in this world typically have a big hole in them somewhere, a need to fill something, and they're looking for the fulfillment of their desires, whatever those desires may be, to fill them up, but never quite do it. So they tend to be kind of constantly dissatisfied with everything in their lives. The world of animality, again, is the world where people are acting based on instinct and are sort of run by their desire for pleasure. So people who are sort of in the grip of alcohol or drugs and can't quit those things, or addicts, sex addicts, food addicts, those types of things, where they just can't seem to control their impulses to seek pleasure. People there tend to be very impulsive, tend to have very tumultuous personal relationships because their main focus really is on just feeling pleasure. The world of anger is interesting. We call it the world of anger, but really, as Ash said, it's the world of insecurity. And the core delusion here is that in order to be happy, you have to be better than everyone else. It's this desire, this intrinsic desire to be thought of and to think of yourself as special and unique. And so people there are quite competitive. They're constantly looking for ways to either subtly or not so subtly put others down to elevate themselves. They're always jockeying for position and trying to figure out how they can make themselves look good. They're very competitive that way. Tranquility, as Ash talked about, these are people who their main goal in life is to avoid pain, and so they will look at every situation from the perspective of how can this harm me, and do everything they can to avoid that harm. And so they tend to enjoy the status quo, be resistant to change, resistant to trying new things, often have anxiety when they don't feel they can avoid pain, and often have a very difficult time making decisions. The world of rapture is a world where people are actually feeling joy and constantly enjoying the things they have. These people tend to be very good. People who live in this world, who have this world as their basic life tendency, tend to be very good at appreciating what they have. And this is a key thing, because if your strategy in life to be happy is to continue to acquire new attachments to make you happy, you're probably from the world of hunger. But if you're good at appreciating the attachments you already have, you're more likely to be in the world of rapture. So these people tend to be very positive, very joy-filled, very energetic, and very good at appreciating what they have, as I said. The world of learning happens to be my world. I'm very familiar with what it's like to be in this world. This is sort of to be operating under the belief that a happy life is a life that is contributive, meaning you're always trying to create value in some way, whether that's build a company, write a book, paint a painting. It doesn't even have to be anything necessarily creative, but in some way you feel that happiness comes from the expression of your values and of your talents in some way. You're building things. People in this world tend to be very single-mindedly focused on that, and as a result often ignore people, don't necessarily value relationships as the most important attachments they have. And sometimes are even sort of hurtful in the way that they are not paying attention to other people. The world of realization is where people are very much focused on developing themselves, which is mostly a very good thing, trying to better themselves in some way, whether in their field or just as a person. And the danger here, though, is that you can become self-obsessed and self-absorbed and so intent on developing yourself that you're ignoring how that has an effect on other people as well. The worlds of learning and realization often go together. The ninth world is the world of compassion, where you are operating under the belief that to be happy, you need to make other people happy as well to help them become happy. And this is the world where the meaning we seek to create is by contributing to the lives of other people. And this is mostly a very positive world. The danger here is that you can be so caught up in helping other people to become happy that you neglect your own happiness. You neglect yourself. And people in this world tend to be caretakers. We're always thinking about other people and very rarely themselves. And the problem here is if you neglect yourself too long, you can become actually resentful towards the people who you are genuinely trying to help. And then finally, the world of enlightenment is a rarely achieved world, although I should point out one of our clues that enlightenment was, if anything, not just a psychological phenomenon, but a neurological phenomenon, comes from the fact that if you look throughout history at all the things that people have written in different times and different cultures, people describe this state using different words, but basically essentially saying the same thing. And it is this state of transcendent joy where everything around you seems fresh and frankly sublime is the word we use in the book. And you're in a continual state of awe around the world. And people in this world are filled not just with a love for other people, but for everything around them. And their greatest concern is the world itself and all the people living in it. And they want nothing more than to help other people achieve the exact same state of transcendent joy that they themselves have achieved.
Can you share with, and I think I know who, you know, some of the names that you're probably thinking of, but can you share some people from history who have achieved that?
Well, the first person, of course, is the historical Buddha himself, right, who apparently, according to legend, sat meditating under a peepal tree and attained enlightenment. But then there was a medieval mystic named Meister Eckhart, and then more modern-day examples might be Eckhart Tolle, who wrote in his book The Power of Now, clearly described that state and having awakened to that state. So what's interesting is when you look at research around this, far more people that you and I know have actually had glimpses of this state. If you ask enough people in your own life, you will find people who know exactly what I'm talking about when I describe this state because they have experienced at least glimpses of it themselves.
Okay. And I have read Eckhart Tolle, so I figured he was one of the names that you were going to mention. So, well, as you were describing those, I caught glimpses of myself in many of those categories. But if I'm understanding correctly, you are saying that we basically fit one primary category and then we can move to different stages as we work? Or am I completely
No, you actually nailed it. You actually nailed it. So, yeah, we all recognize all those worlds because we do move in and out of them. You know, Alex even talked about like a simple thing when you are about to indulge on a nice big piece of chocolate cake, you are smack dab in the middle of the world of animality. And you know, when you're maybe super focused on if you're on a job hunt or like on a project you're working on, you're just fixated or obsessed with that you enter the world of entering the world of hunger because you're so we all can recognize those parts. But it's really what we argue is that everybody has a basic life tendency, which is where they spend the most time, where the belief is the most commonly stirred up, because it's the belief you hold the strongest and most accessible to you. So for me, while I clearly enter these different worlds, I'm, you know, a high powered job here where I probably enter the world of hunger a lot because I'm very focused on that next thing and I place a lot of emphasis on it and get obsessed and neglect other things in my life. My basic state is definitely tranquility, because faced with my view of life or my true kind of defining characteristics when push comes to shove of how I make decisions in my life tends to be from that world, outside of the moment to moment stuff that kind of, you know, happens to everybody. So yes, you go on all these things, but there's one primary, call it core, call it basic. It's the place where you feel it's your home state.
Now, when you take this test, and I'm going to do that, or this, what did you call it?
It's a self-assessment.
Sorry, when you go to your website? Yes, yeah, assessment. And, you know, I could see the word dancing in front of me. I could not get it out of my mouth. But once you take that assessment and you kind of figure out where you are, isn't that a good time to sit down and say, I don't like it here. This is not really where I want to be. This is not how I identified myself. I would suspect that you guys are finding a lot of people who go, what the heck you mean? That's not me. Mm-mm. You know, they had no clue that they landed in one of these categories. I suspect I'll be the same way. I'll probably be arguing with you like, this is wrong. That's not me.
Well,
chances
I think that's exactly right.
Once I sit down and go, all right, fine, they're right. Now what do I do?
That's exactly right. In fact, Ash mentioned how he was surprised to discover he was from the world of tranquility. And interestingly, on our website, in that self-assessment, we have a caveat there, which is that you can't answer the questions we ask you based on what you want to be like, but what you find is actually true about yourself. And that's often very different from what you want to be true and how you think about yourself. And so I think, yes, a number of people have taken this self-assessment or read the book and said, boy, I got to tell you, I don't like the fact that I'm in the world of animality or hunger, but that's really kind of true. And so I would encourage anyone who reads the book or takes the self-assessment that you may have that initial reaction like, no, that's not me. I'm not from that world. But let it sit for a while and really observe yourself and your behavior and ask yourself what beliefs are being stirred up. And ultimately, no one has better access to the beliefs that hold you in their grip than you do. Interestingly, even people who initially said I didn't believe it, as they thought about it, they ultimately said, no, actually, as time has gone by and I've observed myself, I have to agree that I am from the world of animality or hunger or whatever it may be. But, you know, it's not as if, you know, like you said, you may not like being from one of the lower worlds because being labeled lower makes it sound like it's inferior. But it is the first step to figure out, all right, if you admit to yourself, yeah, you know what, I spent a lot of my time in the lower world. I spent a lot of my time trying to feel superior to other people or chasing after things that I think are going to fulfill me that ultimately disappoint me. How do I get out? How do I get myself into these higher worlds? And the answer is, it's easy to be in the lower worlds. You don't have to do any work to be in the lower worlds. But the higher worlds require work of you, and it requires you cultivate beliefs that will land you in those worlds and try to do things that help stir them up more so that you can gradually crawl into those worlds and spend more time in them. I think it's important to recognize, you know, we all, as Ash said, we all circle through all of these worlds. The issue isn't you're going to land in one world and just stay there and never have to visit, you know, the lower worlds again. The answer is, how do you increase the time you spend in the higher worlds, which by definition are yield greater happiness? And the answer is by cultivating the beliefs that create those worlds. And that, again, to go back to what we talked about earlier, is first becoming mindful and recognizing where you actually are, being honest with yourself, and then beginning to cultivate beliefs in those other higher worlds. Because how does anyone cultivate a belief in anything? It's, you know, one way is to look for evidence that it's true and to try it out. You know, so for me in the world of learning, for example, no matter how hard I try, I cannot escape my belief that creating meaningful things, creating value, building things, writing books, whatever it may be, seeing patients, helping them, you know, with their troubles, makes me happy. Because the truth is, it does. It really does. Yet it is like all type of happiness in the nine worlds other than enlightenment, it is temporary. That doesn't mean, and this is important to say, that doesn't mean it's a happiness not worth striving for. It just means that there's a different type of happiness that can be had. Because I should also mention that even once you enter the world of enlightenment, it doesn't mean that you still don't care to create value for other people or help other people or enjoy physical pleasure. You're just doing it from a more enlightened position.
And this question popped up while you were talking, because I'm going to go take the assessment I meant to yesterday, and it's on my list of things to do today. Once this, and this is a question I'm sure somebody's going to be asking in the chat room, once we've taken that assessment and we've made the decision to kind of sit with that and go, that's not right, or, oh, okay, maybe it is right now, I need to, you know, do the work, make some changes, can we then go back and take that assessment again from a fresh new understanding, or is it kind of a one and done?
I think that I believe that you know, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think people could fundamentally change their core, you know, their basic beliefs, and their core beliefs are at least ones that are stood up the most. I believe in that. So I think, and by the way, my experience so far has not been as people has been as resistant. I mean, most of the people I know have taken it have sort of been this resigned. Oh God, this is me. And then they try to kind of dig deep to understand what that means for them. But I believe that as you make beliefs more accessible to you, the whole point of doing that is that you can start, you know, eliminating the grip they have on your life and having them stirred up less and less and less. And I think people should, you know, I'm not sure what period of time or over what, you know, duration, but I think if you do the work and you confront some of this and you actually truly start believing that belief is not being stirred up in you as much as it used to, then it's probably something worth going and taking a look again and seeing if it changes over time. That would be some interesting research that we can do. We clearly haven't done that yet.
Yeah, I would love to actually do that. You know, I've got it in the back of my head that I'll take the first assessment. I'll take the assessment. I'm going to call it the first one. And unless it limits, you know, how many times the same email address can go back, I don't know how you all have it set up. But I would love to kind of monitor myself and see, am I moving up? Have I changed anything?
Well, but let me just make one more comment about that. I actually, again, we don't have as much data on this yet, but some early results kind of have indicated this, but I think there's definitely a life stage impact as well. I think having different things happen in your life, being in different stages, having kids, you know, you can imagine that as you get, for example, as you get older, it's not crazy to believe that the ideas of security and tranquility, that world starts getting you more in your grip because you feel you have more to lose. And so that belief gets stirred up more often versus when you were younger and in college, whatever, maybe it's all about getting what you want because you believe that it's about achievement. So, you know, I think there's things that are very real things that happen in your life that impact what those beliefs are stirred up. So it's not just about you doing the work to try to understand it. It also might be the different events that happen in your life that might actually cause you to enter and stay in and hang on to beliefs from different worlds.
I'd add one thing,
oh,
too,
that makes
and that is
sense.
I'd add one other thing, and that beliefs do not change easily. And it's not something you can just decide to change with willpower. You know, it's sort of like feelings. We're not necessarily in control of what we believe or what beliefs are stirred up in us. And we write in the book a lot about the process by which wisdom, meaning beliefs, actually, you know, dysfunctional beliefs get replaced with more functional or adaptive beliefs. It's fascinating. And there's fascinating research around this. And so I think your idea about coming back to the self-assessment and, you know, periodically to reassess yourself is a brilliant one. But I would say, you know, don't expect too much too fast. If you read about how we talk about how insight has this amazing ability to produce changes in beliefs, you know, after a fundamental insight you might have about yourself, that would be the time, I think, to come back and see if you answer the questions we pose a little differently and get a different result.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Because, you know, I was thinking, well, I'll just, you know, periodically pick a date and go over there. But you're right. I have to have, you know, something that has challenged me to say, okay, have I changed this? So thank you for that. And I will be taking that, you know, quite a bit. So you'll see me pop up there probably more often than you want. But, you know, I would really like to track and see where I'm going and if I'm actually doing the work. I think that's important. So,
yeah,
okay, doctors, thank you. Thank you. Where can people find you on the web? I know you've mentioned it once. Let's do it again so people can definitely locate you.
Yep. So you can find us, the website at the10worlds.com, where you can learn about the book, take the assessment, and also, you know, buy it or at least link out to buying it. And then, of course, you can buy the book at Amazon and Barnes & Noble's and all the places books are sold online or even at bookstores locally.
Excellent. And the links to both of your websites and Amazon are in my show notes here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you so much. It has been really a genuine pleasure speaking with you both, and I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and advice that you've shared with our audience, and I hope they will go find that book and definitely take that self-assessment. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes, excuse me, Just look for your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you. Great.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottogovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.